for those, you know, who came last week and maybe who didn't, some of the things we talked about. We talked about the body, and in that there's emotions and desire, and we hardly speak about desire without speaking about sexual desire. And we talked about, remember, the path of the stoic as one response to the hunger in our hearts, the desire for love, sex, and intimacy. The path of the stoic, that is the repression of desire, who responds to the hunger in the heart by trying to stuff it away. And that's one option. The other option we talked about was the path of the addict, who is the path of indulging in the desire. Repressing over here, indulging over here. And the addict is taking his or her infinite hunger and reaching to finite things to try to fill that. And is never satisfied. And we talked about, we introduced this path of the mystic as this alternative to both extremes. And we talked about St. Teresa of Avila as one example of that. And maybe I didn't explain this well enough. What's the difference between the mystic and these other two? The mystic is the one who opens her hunger completely to Jesus. Instead of repressing desires or indulging desires just as they are, the mystic is the one who exposes everything before Jesus and stays in the ache of the hunger, who has the courage to burn and let her heart be stretched. So that's what the real difference between the mystic and the repressing path is. You really feel the hunger and you live it, and you allow the Lord to fill you and satisfy you. In some ways in this life, there's real satisfaction, but ultimately in heaven is where it's fully there. There's to live in this path, there's always going to be some type of aching. Okay? So that's one thing we talked about. Another thing we talked about was kind of this central analogy that the whole kind of theology of the body is based on, this framework of the what Ephesians 5 says about marriage, pointing to the relationship Jesus has with his church. Church meaning all of us. We talked about the wedding of Genesis foreshadows the wedding that happens in Revelation, the marriage of Christ and the church. That the whole point of this marriage, this is this crazy glorious thing, the whole point of this marriage is to reveal, anticipate, and proclaim to the whole world that this marriage is the real deal. And it's what we're made for. And it's a wedding banquet that all of us are invited to. All of us. And we can understand why some might skip the sign of earthly marriage to enter more deeply into the reality of heavenly marriage even now in the path of celibacy. Why? Because they're avoiding love? No. Because this is the ultimate love we're made for. This is the vision. Now, it's important to address some concerns. I received some concerns last week that we used a lot of imagery that was maybe a little bit discomforting for some people last week. When we kind of approach talking about sexuality from where our culture is, kind of with like pornographic lenses, right? And we spoke of what Jesus does on the cross as kind of an act, and we spoke of the blood and water flowing from his side, remember, as a way that gave life to the church. Now, I just want to bring that up again to make sure it's very clear. When we speak about marriage and even the sexual act, we're not talking about a sexual act isolated from a lifetime of love and service in marriage. The only way this sign works is sex as the whole, encompassing the whole history of married life in self-donation to one another. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing, too, is we're using the best analogy possible. When we speak about the call for two to become one, pointing to the marriage of Christ and the church, we're speaking via analogy. It's the best analogy we have. But we got to remember there are real limitations to it. So as long as we get that understanding, it's not completely perfect to speak of the things that happen in earthly marriage with man and woman. It doesn't fully encompass and tell you everything about things in the economy of salvation. But it's a really darn good analogy, and it's worth paying attention to. It would be wrong of us to assume that the action of Christ on the cross somehow reveals and points to this final destination of sex as the answer to everything. That's not what we're saying. That's not what I said last week. What happens in Christ on the cross certainly informs us more about sex and God's original plan for it and what we're made for, and vice versa. But it's all in terms of where God's design is. God is not made in our image. We are made in God's image. Okay? So it's all right if you get a little confused or irritated or scandalized. That's wonderful. Let's keep going. All right. Melissa is going to take us into the beginning of John Paul II's discourse of the theology of the body. And he says, the way that you understand, this is just the setup for everything Melissa's going to talk about. He's saying, when I speak about marriage, you know, we live in a very broken world. What does marriage even mean? What does relationship and sexuality even mean? We have this distorted, broken view of that. And if we're trying to look at that right now, where our world is and from our own experience, it doesn't seem to thrust us into this sign of the marriage of Christ and the church. It doesn't seem to articulate that. But Jesus says, in the beginning, it was not so. So Christ moves to the beginning to show us that we need to spend time looking at man and woman before the fall of sin to be able to make this analogy make any sense. Melissa Ginther.
So I'm going to be shameless and tell you my favorite part about speaking to young adults is I can do this when I get thirsty. And it doesn't have to be water, which is great. My name is Melissa Ginther, as both Joeys said. I teach at St. Pius X. A little bit more about me. I have an identical twin. She looks a lot like this. She lives in Leesburg, Virginia, so if you see anyone wandering around Atlanta, it's me and not her, more than likely. I play college softball. I sleep like this. We're on a journey. I'm a person. I'm not just a speaker coming to like shove knowledge down your throat. And I want to, you're like, why did you just tell me how you sleep? I don't know. Right? Because we're human persons and we're in this together. And so I want to invite you into my reflections and share with you, if you feel like I'm trying to fit the ocean to the water into a water bottle, it's because I am. If you feel like you're drinking out of the end of a fire hose, it's because you are. There's a lot in this teaching, right? John Paul II, just for a moment, if you'll indulge me going backwards. John Paul II had this written before he became pope. So he's a priest at 28, a bishop at 38, a cardinal at 48, and made pope around 58. And before he gets to Rome, as a celibate man, he writes like 300 pages about how we are created, how it points us to the divine. So I'm going to try to explain this. Actually, I'm going to try to explain this, and the rest of it, hopefully one day you'll read yourself. You should read this as a faithful Catholic who desires to live by the teachings of the church. He's great. He's a great teacher because what he does is he says it and then he takes a step back and says it a little differently and takes a step back and says it a little differently, time and time again in 129 Wednesday audiences. He could have, I guess, made it an encyclical and dropped it into the world's lap and said, "Hey, read it." But instead, like a father, he sat down with his children for 129 essentially Wednesdays in a row and said, "Let me tell you the meaning of life." Let me tell you why you were made. Let me tell you about your desires and what their purpose is. Let me tell you that you are good and that every desire you have is good. It draws you to something greater. He says this within, so if you ever see these numbers as I'm talking, right, that's the audience and the paragraph number. So he knows we're lazy and we don't want to read whole pages, so he won't even say like, page 129, that's audience 46, paragraph 6 in the text. It says this, TOB concerns the whole of the Bible and plunges us into the perspective of the whole gospel, of the whole teaching, even more of the whole mission of Christ. What is Christ about? Read this. What is the church about? Read this. If you're too lazy, like me, most of the time, to read this, I would suggest, if you got a little bit of extra money laying around or have friends who are willing to pay for you to go somewhere, to go to, Christopher West is phenomenal, and I used to give him a hard time after reading Theology of the Body, because I would say he didn't do an authentic job representing Theology of the Body in the whole of its context. And what I recognized was, it's not that he doesn't do justice to it. He doesn't do justice to it in the three-day seminars when he comes into a city and presents. So if you want to dive headlong into this teaching, Christopher West does a head and heart immersion course. I don't get paid for this plug at all. that I would suggest you going to, because it is incredible. Joey, I know you want me to use this microphone, but I think I'm going to get rid of it. Is that okay?
Okay, great. I'm a teacher, so I'm allowed. And that's restrictive. So, Theology of the Body affords the rediscovery of the meaning of life, the whole existence. It's a bold claim. George Weigel, who wrote one of the biographies about the Pope, says that Theology of the Body is the ticking time bomb, the catalyst that's going to go off and reshape all of theology in the third millennium. So what is it? That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked. What he does, he paints two triptychs, or triptych, I don't know how to say it, I'm not an art person, you can correct me later, right? But what a triptych is, it's kind of like an icon, right, when there's the big picture in the middle, and they have the two like little side flaps that come out, right? Can I yell ahead and not? Okay, great, I'm a teacher, so we're going to have call and response the whole time, it's great. But what he does in the first chapter, in the second chapter, is he creates one of these, and he looks to Matthew 19 and says, let me tell you about the beginning. And that's where we're going to hang out tonight. But then he builds piece by piece as he goes throughout. And so we're going to hang out with original man, with Adam and Eve. What was in the garden? What was going on? Why? What was so good, or what was very good about you and I in the garden? And then man screws it up. And I would just like to defend Eve and Adam that it's both of our faults. Right? Because when we look to Genesis, what happens in the garden? Man has one job. It's like the paint where somebody screws it up, like painting fire and it's fry by the end of it. Right? One job that God has given to Adam, to protect the garden and everything in it. And in the beginning, God puts Eve in there, and then the serpent comes in. Actually, the way the Hebrew translates, it's more like a dragon comes in. And he talks to Eve. She eats the apple. We know. She screwed up. I get it. Okay? But what does she do next? She turns to the groom, and he takes a bite. He was right there the whole time. And so in the garden, we have this mutual screw-up that just sends us towards the sexual revolution barreling full steam ahead. Right? And that trajectory, if grace isn't interjected, is just going to keep going and going and going. Right? But God, in the garden, before they ever leave, makes a promise. It's called the Proto-Evangelium, the first good news, that he will put enmity back between the woman and the serpent. That he's going to restore it. And what's so incredible, Aquinas gets it right. Right? Oh, happy fault. Oh, necessary sin of Adam. That the garden's not where we're going back to. The good news is we're heading beyond the garden. That we're not just made to be back to the beginning. That we want to surpass the beginning. And to be called into divinization. To be, right, to partake in God's very nature. So this isn't just news about, let me go get baptized and let me go to confession when I screw up. This is news about the very meaning of our lives, the very meaning of our existence. That's at the heart of this. This is the good news. So Matthew 19, what's going on? For those of you who don't read scripture as much as I do, I'm a nerd trapped in a semi-athlete's body. I say semi with heavy emphasis on the semi. Right? Matthew 19, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees and Sadducees, and they're trying to find a reason to kill him. So they keep trapping him, like backing him into these corners. And the Pharisees come to him and say, oh, we got it. This is the Melissa version. Don't put quotes around this if you write it down. Right? They go to Jesus and they're like, hey, Moses said we can divorce. What say you? And all of a sudden, if you're reading the scripture, if you're in the moment, you're like, ooh, what's he going to say? Right? And Jesus turns to them in Matthew 19 and says, in the beginning, it was not so. That Moses permitted it for the hardness of your hearts. That nugget, John Paul II pulls out and writes 150 pages about. In the beginning, it was not so. So how was it? What was it like in the beginning? We read Genesis 1. There are two creation accounts in Genesis. The second of the two is the older of the two. And in the second of the two, we read, right, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So man created them, male and female, he created them. But why? What's the big deal? What about that is in the image of God? You'll have some theologians who will limit it simply to the fact that man is an intellectual being, right? That man is like God in that regard. But then Genesis 2 goes on before the original sin and details how man, how woman is drawn out of Adam's Eve, and we'll talk about why and the symbolism in a second. But that as woman is drawn out of Adam, that beautiful sign of equality, right? That rib next to you, not from the head so that she's above or the feet that he lords over her, but this equality, that there's this beautiful unity between the two in the beginning. And something about that is why man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and the two become one. And something about that is the image. So what about it? We're going to go through these four words: solitude, unity, nakedness, innocence. They're the four original things we see in the garden. That Adam is originally in solitude, Eve for a moment is also in solitude. That they are originally meant for unity, that we're so meant for unity, that they're naked without shame, as we read in Genesis, right? And this beautiful gift of innocence and grace that is also there. So, Genesis 2, verse 18. God creates Adam, right? And we need to recognize when we're reading through the story of Genesis, it's not a literal historical account. It was not the purpose. But it does convey truth. So what is the truth that's being conveyed? We look to Adam, who's made from the dust, right? Drawn forth, God breathes life into him. And then God says to him, it's not good for man to be alone. I tell God all that time, that in prayer, I'm like, Lord, you said it's not good. Come on, man. Right? It's not good for man to be alone. And so it says in scripture, then God begins to create all the animals. Yes, I know, scientific timeline, a little out of whack. But what's the truth at the heart? He looks to man, and he starts to create things. And man has what's called original subjectivity, original self-consciousness, and self-determination. What do I mean by that? What does Adam do? Cow, snake, anaconda, elephant, right? He names the animals. So we see this subjectivity. He recognizes who he is and what other things are, and he gets the gift of naming, right? I don't know what language he named in or if it was with words. I don't even know. We don't get that, right? But that there's this dominion he has in the garden and this capacity of self-consciousness. Because God makes this proclamation and he keeps seeing these things and he's naming them and he's going through them, but there's no suitable helpmate for him. There's nothing made in his image or after his own likeness. And so we see this echo, and then God casts a deep sleep on Adam, right, and draws Eve from his side. And in that moment, right, Eve comes forth. Eve comes forth. Oh, hold on. I'm jumping ahead. First of all, we also need to recognize it's not like God was like, oh, I should probably create her too. Right? I love Michelangelo's depiction in the Sistine Chapel of the creation of Adam. Because what do you see under God's arm? You see Eve. But there's a plan from the beginning. And in the, if you see the pink around it, right, it's the membrane of the brain. Right? That in the mind of God, he already knew what he was going to do. And so he creates Eve. And there's this moment, this beautiful poetic imagery. Joey speaks more poetically than I do. I'm like, let me tell you like this and this and this and this, right? But then when there's this beautiful moment that captivates us in Genesis, and if you read through your scriptures, you see it kind of like bracketed and set off to the side. He says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Can I get two men and one woman for a volunteer? I'm going to bring you on stage. I just want you to move. Sorry, teacher life. All right, one, two, and one more man. Come on.
There we go.
All right, come on. Come on up. You're like, what did I just volunteer myself for?
Where are we going? Over here?
Yeah. What's your name?
Christian.
Christian. Oh, that's perfect. You're now God. Well done. You've accomplished a lot today. Kevin is the same here. This is Adam.
What's your name?
Madison.
Madison. So in the beginning, actually, let's invert this. Can I flip you two? Will you two face one another? And will you face them?
God.
That in the beginning, when Adam is created and he sees Eve, what's going on in the garden where they don't screw it up is when Adam looks to Eve, he says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, my anatomy tells me you're with me, I'm with you, we're made for one another. But it's not a I want to take, it's a hey, when I look at Eve, I see God. But this is the unity in the garden. That when he looks around, you can face that way. When he looks around in the beginning, partly because you're just like, right? When he looks around in the beginning, there's nothing suitable for him. There's nothing that another Adam can give him that Eve's not going to give him, except for one thing. And that thing makes him in the image and likeness of God. That the thing in the beginning that Eve gives to Adam, that no other Adam could give to Adam, that in the mutual exchange of selves, he becomes father. She becomes mother. And in that is an image and likeness of the Trinity. In that, at the heart of that, is the linchpin of the theology of the body. Is the linchpin of what theology of the body is, which is a defense of humanae vitae, which hopefully you're not surprised by this. Paul VI in Humanae Vitae, right, affirms, and all the bishops are like losing their ever-loving minds when this happens, because they're all saying, yes to contraception. Yes, 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 yes. Do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. And the Pope says, nope. And in Humanae Vitae, he says, somebody's going to need to take this and explain it. And that's what theology of the body is. And what happens in the original sin, if you'll face one another again, but I'm going to bring you with me. And Adam, he'll turn around. You can face one another still. What happens after the sin? Is Adam still gazing at Eve? But he no longer sees God through her. That he's lost the purpose of her creation, which is to draw him to God himself. And vice versa. They're set up perfectly, so I won't move them. Because in the beginning, so too is Adam supposed to draw Eve to God himself. And that in this, we're drawn into the Godhead himself. Thank you. Take a seat. So this unity in the beginning, John Paul II says, affirms and confirms original solitude or original subjectivity, that man in the beginning, unlike anything else, could say I, that he was the only person in the garden. And so in the beginning, in the garden, as they make this mutual exchange of selves to one another, right, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, aha, like, out of you, what's the first thing he says about her? From you, the whole human race will spring forth. There's a reason, right? We call it matrismoni, holy matrimony, to make a mother of, to make a father of. That's what we celebrate in the sacraments of the church. But there's this openness in the beginning to everything the other has to give, that there's no rejection of any gift to be given. So we have that common good, that common linchpin of both the bond between the two, but also the common linchpin of the potential gift of life.
Because what's going on in eternity? What's going on that these two are echoing for us in the garden? John Paul II and many theologians before and after him have pointed to the fact that what is the Father doing? The Father for all of eternity is pouring out himself so effectively that there's always a Son being begotten. This is the language we speak in the Creed, right? If there's a Father, there's a child, right? So the fact that God is Father and always has been, right? And he reveals this. We don't name him this. He reveals himself as Father. Reveals to us that there's always sonship. And sonship reveals to us that there's always fatherhood. And there's this eternal gift that's so strong that it spirates a third person. And so in the garden, in the original unity, man and woman reflect that. That in the full gift, in the take this, you, my whole body, right? That Christ echoes at the Last Supper. And in Adam's, take this, my whole body, everything I am, all of me. That 9 months later, there's the potential that we have to name it. That it spirates into a third person. So why does the church teach what she teaches? Because the very heart of who we are is self-gift. Because the very heart of who we are echoes for all of eternity who God is. What a beautiful gift that the good news was already stamped from the beginning. And we didn't lose that sign, that primordial sacrament, as John Paul II calls it. So in their unity, right, they're drawn together. We've already talked about this. All right, I'll read the quote and then we'll keep going. This is why man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and the two of them become one body or one flesh. The man and his wife are both naked, and yet they felt no shame. When we look to nakedness, oh, it went too far. That was supposed to be like a quality, like pulling a picture moment. So sad. All right. So in unity, when we look to Eve, and she's drawn into God, and there's this innocence, this without shame. I don't want you to imagine it, right? We look at little children. Children are shameless in a very beautiful way, right? I have a good friend. She has a 1.5-year-old named Francis, and he's like, no diaper, papa, woo! And just runs around, right? And there's beauty in that. But when I want to talk about innocence, when I want to talk about shameless, I want to talk about the way a bride and a groom look at one another. I just thought that was awesome. I love it. And there's another one where he like pulls his chin out. It's great. That in their innocent gift to one another, it's not this innocence that doesn't say, I am wholeheartedly drawn to you. Every fiber of my being wants to bring you to myself. The way in which John Paul II and Benedict XVI and Pope Francis, all three of them have spoke about it. Right, eros. And our language has been hijacked. And we have to reclaim it. It's the only way we get back to the heart of it. That erotic love is not something unchristian. It's something so wholly Christian that it makes us holy. That what happens in the garden is that rocket-like trajectory that cultivated in Adam draws him outside of himself, makes a gift of himself, and leads him straight to heaven. Because what is he doing? He's saying, this is my body given up for you. That this innocence is total gift. And that this innocence isn't just like this subtle, like, hey, I like you. You're kind of cute. Oh my gosh, freshman in the hallway outside my classroom. Right? Actually, they're more colorful than that. And I'm like, oh, you're in the theology hallway. Right? But in that innocence, it's not just this gentle, like, hey, you're kind of cute. It's this wild, erotic draw to the other. And not a draw that desires to take. What happens in the garden? Where do we screw up? The fruit is taken and not received. Right? That the gift is plucked rather than waited for. Reverence never rushes the gift. That these are two of my friends. Four of my friends. Sorry. They're one flesh. It's fine. Ashley and Kevin knew one another. They're the picture on this side, the brighter picture. Knew one another for about 6 years
And as Kevin started to pursue Ashley, Ashley was like, hey, what is this? And he's like, hey, I like you. And she's like, no. And says no a couple times. And in prayer, Kevin shares this story that he would share if he was here himself, that he waited. And God said, she will come. Like, you are going to be united, but have patience. Wait upon me moving in her heart. And the mighty trust that took from him. Right? Because I was watching it on both sides happen. And I'm like, I don't know if she's going to say that. Wait. Right?
But he never, out of reverence for her, rushed the gift. And he never took the gift. He says, this is my body. And if you want to join me in that mutual self-gift, great. If not, love would rather one leave and be happy than to take what is not theirs and be distorted. And so this beautiful patience that drove him in virtue, that drew him closer to the Lord.
So the full encounter with the original meaning of the body is protected in this innocence. And we call this innocence in the beginning. You've heard it. It's called grace. That man was made in a state of grace. And that when man screws up, it's not that when Adam and Eve make the mistake that they gain something new, right? Original sin or the fallen human nature. It's well spoken of, right? Fallen. They fell out of, they cut off, they rejected, right? Grace. Side note. In the beginning, the fruit on the tree, we read in Scripture, we read in Genesis, was good for food and pleasing to the eye. But God said no. God said wait. The church isn't saying sex is bad. It's good and pleasing. But it's not to be taken, it's to be received. So when we look to the beginning, when we look to grace, grace helps us protect. We need grace. We are not Manichaean. We can't do it on our own. We're not Pelagian. I can't sanctify myself. I really need God, which is hard for us to say. We like, right, the twin difficulties of self-reliance and self-perfection. But there's something in the human heart that says, I can make the best version of me. Now, we're called to be virtuous, right? God has given us real character to develop. But grace is necessary to restore this. Because, damn, this is hard. And if we don't say and if we don't claim that, we're fooling ourselves. Because this is the error that comes again and again in salvation history. Right? Read through the scriptures. They're scandalous. The errors that happen time and time again are often related to the difficulty of maintaining reverence for the gift of the other. Time and time again. Who are we to think we're going to be different in that regard? And also, who are we to think that our struggle has not been one that the saints have taken up and conquered by the grace of God? That we're not alone in the fight, right? Hebrews, I think it's chapter 11. We are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. And they're not just the ones in eternity. There's a reason we're the church militant. We're in this together. We're called to fortify one another in this. To share. I'm sorry, this is just the best way to say it. Please, we might have to edit this part out. To share the shit. Because it's hard. Right? That you are your brother's keeper. And that's not a phrase of just, how you doing, man? I'm fine. Okay, good. I don't have to help you. Right? I always joke with my teenagers, when you tell me you're fine, I think you're freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. Right? You can hijack it and use it for your own. That in our humanity, there's a real difficulty no matter what side of this equation we're on. Whether we stand in the posture of waiting for the gift, or if we stand in the posture of already having the gift, that it's been given to us by another, it's hard. The church's teaching about contraception, about the proper fulfillment of the theology of the body, about the spousal meaning of the body, it's difficult. And if we make mistakes, the good news is grace has been restored. The font has been opened, right? We can return to again and again and again. And it's not from a place of shame. We don't return to Christ for him to condemn us. We return to Christ, right, that he sets the world ablaze, that the rocket engines can be reoriented, and that we can launch to the stars. But this draw is the very draw of the gospel. When we look to the beginning, when we look to man and woman,
just a little etymology lesson for you in our culture that's trying to redefine. When you redefine words, you technically undefine them because they're up for redefinition again and again and again. I say this with great gentleness. Looking at teenagers in my own classroom who, what I'm about to say is, for some of them, the greatest difficulty that they face in their entire lives. I'm about to make a comment on sex and gender. And I don't say it in such a way to condemn if it is a difficulty that you or anyone you know have. Because it is a real, authentic difficulty. The church says, in the beginning, God made them male and female, and it was good. That who I am is not just, I'm not a soul trapped in a body. That my body, let me use theology words for a second, speaks an ontological and metaphysical truth to the world. What? That the being I have is a human being, true, but it's a feminine being. That something about my soul, about the very core of who I am, is feminine. In the beginning, right, the word sexus, the Latin word for sex, right, means difference. And so when we name the sexes, we recognize a biological difference. When we name the genders, right? Gender comes from the same word of generation, literally meaning the way in which we generate, right? That at the very core of who I am, that those things are bound together. They cannot be divorced. Now, there is a real difficulty for some who feel the tug of their divorce. And if that's you, no, I'm not trying to pick on you. That's not my intention at all. I actually want to reverence that difficulty because it's incredibly difficult. Right? But at the heart of theology, the body is the goodness of our creation. That who I am is feminine. And as I stand next to the brothers within our church who hold the disposition of the masculine, it's not, right, we go back to the rib. It's not in such a way that masculine is meant to lord over feminine, or else we would have been taken from Adam's foot. Or that woman is supposed to lord over man because then woman would have been taken from Adam's head. But that there's a side-by-side, a complementarity conveyed in the beginning. I don't know if you know anything about complementary colors. If you're an artist, maybe you do. It works even within music, right? That there are notes that melodies and things that blend well within music when it's done well. That when complementary colors are put side by side, they amplify the other. They perfect, in a certain sense, the other. So that when man is put with woman in the garden, it's not to distort, and we can't blur the lines. Because when you mix colors, you just get that brown, ugh, right? That in that beautiful symmetry between the two, when they interweave, right, when they become bound together but not confused, but in that beautiful symmetry, in that beautiful complementarity, is this amplification of what is already there, right? That it makes it more profound, that it kind of jumps better than it's ever jumped off the page before, when it stands in isolation, right? We see this in the beginning. When John Paul II speaks of nakedness in the beginning, man's original nakedness, yes, in the nude, nakedness, true. But it's not this nakedness that's just simply the body. I want you to turn to your neighbor, and I'm going to make you incredibly uncomfortable for about 20 seconds, but I need you to be able to look at someone else.
Does anybody not have someone to look eye to eye to? All right, don't stare down one another yet. Some of you are like, I know what we're doing. Hold on, hold your horses, overachievers. When was the last time you were seen? And I don't just mean physically. When was the last time you allowed another to peer at you in such a way to encounter you? Now, here's what I'm gonna ask you to do, and the temptation there, might be a moment of giggles. So we'll just embrace that and then we'll quiet it down after that. I just want you to spend 15 seconds looking at someone else in the eye. And for a moment, see if you can see them. Does that make sense? For a moment. Now, here's the thing. This is not the intent of this is not a sexual intent, right? So if you're staring at a dude and you're a dude, that's fine, right? Ladies are like, oh, it's fine. This is what we do in sleepovers anyways, right? Now you know. Not really. Some of you are like, it's so true. But I just want you to take 15 seconds and just see the other person. And then I'm going to ask you one question when you're done. So I will tell you when the 15 seconds is up, go ahead and look at the other person. And for 15 seconds, and I'll start the time when the giggling stops. So let's see if we can do it in silence. All right. So for 15 seconds, introduce yourself real quick if you don't know the person's name. Like, this is really good to my son, and I don't even know you. All right. For 15 seconds, allow yourself to be seen. Go. Here's my one question. How many of you were wildly uncomfortable? How many of you felt like somebody saw you for the first time today? Actually saw you? One, get a couple head nods. Then how often in my day do I stop and encounter the other? Because what happens
in the garden is Adam doesn't just look to Eve and see a body, but he sees a person. And Eve allows herself to be seen. How often do we throw up the defenses in our common culture that don't actually let other people see me? And I don't just mean in the good parts, right? We like photo and edit and post good parts for the world to see, right? Here's my like filtered version of my life. But how often are people in my life? And yes, it's probably a little easier for the ladies than the gents. But how often do I actually let people see me? And it's gonna look different. Girls, it might look like coffee and chocolate, I don't know. For the men, maybe it's going on a hike, I don't know, I'm not a dude, sorry, right? But how often do I encounter the other? Because yes, in a particular way, Eve gives herself to Adam in the garden, but in a very beautiful way, right? Had it continued, they would have still been naked in the garden with other people. So nakedness doesn't just indicate this bodily nakedness, but that they allowed all of themselves to be seen. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, there wasn't a lot of ugly in the garden, really any. But the pursuit of virtue in the Christian life, to call to be seen by the other, to call to be journeyed with by the other. And it's not that the difficult stuff is bad. And as our culture has hijacked from us, it's not that the body is bad, right? When somebody barges in on a bathroom, it's not like we cover up ourselves and be like, oh, I'm horrible, right? We guard and we protect what is sacred. Worthy of being reverenced in the beginning. And so I'm not saying go cast your pearls before swine, right? Your difficulties in life, just let anybody have them. But am I letting anybody have them? Am I letting anybody see me, journey with me, be my brother's keeper with me? Because in the garden, in that seeing of one another, Adam and Eve really both experienced what's called a theophany, as John Paul II articulates it. That in looking to Eve, Adam doesn't just see her in her humanity, that he's drawn to God, that he has an encounter with the divine in the other.
Christ, when he is raised from the dead, chooses to keep something of fallen humanity in his wounds. That in the garden, there was no wound to be drawn to God through, but post the garden, we're drawn to the divine through the cross. And that the mess, that the difficulty, is part of what draws us to the resurrection. So that when I journey with the other, when I journey with Christ, when I do the Stations of the Cross, right? We commemorate this as Catholics. We keep Jesus on the cross in our churches, not because Good Friday was the end, but because Good Friday was the only way we got to Easter. And how are we to think that we're not going to get to Easter in our own lives without a Good Friday? If the fight for theology of the body to be won in your life is difficult, take courage, as John Paul II says. Be not afraid to open wide the doors to Christ. Because in that is the journey of the saints, through the cross to the glory. St. Augustine, I think Joey said this last week, St. Augustine, I think I have two more points, by the way, so if you're like in the, come on, Melissa, I'm almost there. St. Augustine says, he who is lost in passion is less lost than the one who has lost his passion. I typed that before, so if there's a screw up in that, sorry. Right? He who is lost in passion is less lost than the one who has lost his passion. That as the church, we're often given this, as Joey called it, right, the mystic or the stoic or the, I forget the other words. I'm going to use a slightly different analogy because I like food. The world says, hey, it's all about the fast food. And actually, yeah, fast food. Right? And then the saint sometimes in the church says, I got to white knuckle and starve. No to the desire, no to the desire, no to the desire. Right? We looked to that film last week about Catholic school dances. Right? There is a demon in you, and it's called lust, if you aren't here. That's not what we teach at Pius. But that sometimes we're told that sanctity equals no, 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 no. And we white knuckle it to eternity. I'm not saying you won't get to eternity, but I ain't living that kind of life. And the saints didn't live that kind of life. And on the flip side of that, it's the fast food or the dumpster. Give it to me now. Give it to me how I want it, when I want it, and because I want it. And the church is saying, you were made for the banquet. You were made for the best. That it's not no, 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 never. It's in the process, in the beauty of the seven-course, five-course, however course, many-course meal. That's the glory. That's the beauty. That in the journey, that when we lose our passion, that we're more lost than the one going dumpster diving. And so my question for you as a Christian, wherever you find yourself off of center, right? And if most of us are honest, most of us probably find ourselves leaning this way of center, towards the dumpster, towards the give me what I want, when I want, because I want it, whenever I want it, rather than the no, never. But wherever we find ourselves, we're called to that middle ground, right? Aristotle, the virtue of the median. The middle. And so we're called to cultivate that desire. But desire, there's three words, and we'll end with this. Desire, destiny, and design. That in our desires, your desires for the other, your desire to make a self-gift, to be a self-gift, to be seen, is good. And desire is by design. It's not like in the garden, God was like, oops, didn't think you were going to want things. That our desires, our good desires, are by design. That they were put in us for a purpose. And what is that purpose? They point to our destiny. The word sin, well, first of all, the word desire comes from the Latin word desirare. It means from the stars or of the stars. Right? That there's something transcendent about our desires. And the word destiny means to set one's aim. It's an archer's term. Right? So when you set your aim, right, you know where you want your arrow to go. And the word sin is also an archer's term. Means to miss the mark. So when my desires aren't pointed to my destiny, that's when I fall off a little bit. And what do I have to fix? Not the fact that I want to release the arrow, but I got to work to the human heart. That's what John Paul II does in the whole rest of the book, the whole rest of his audiences, is he says, hey, that echo in your heart, that ethos in the human heart, the ethic, needs to be reoriented. You need to put on new lenses. A paradigm shift is his actual language. And he says this, and this is what I'll leave you with, jumping lots of pages, is we're called to live in freedom and redemption, freedom of our redemption. What does that mean? Do we believe that what Jesus did actually got us grace? Because what John Paul II is saying is this difficult teaching to uphold requires grace. And it's not a grace that leads us astray. It's a grace that radically catalyzes and converts and changes everything. But we have to lean into it. Free people make the world so nervous. Right? That when we can lean into grace, to the really divine life within us, that he can restore that in us. And he says the two ways in which we do that, right? Live in the freedom of redemption with holiness. Holiness and profane are words that are kind of connected. Holiness means set apart, and things that were holy, right? Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts. They were things put in the temple. And the word profanum, right? Profane means outside of the temple, right? It doesn't mean evil. It means it wasn't for the temple. It wasn't for the sacrifice. It wasn't for the sacred. So when John Paul II calls us to holiness, right, he calls us to restore the temple. What is meant to be a part of the temple? How is the temple meant to be kept? And so next week, we're going to get real practical. I'm bringing in lots of people who know way more than I do. And they're going to talk about the modern implications of this, where the rubber hits the road. But we're called to live in that place of holiness and reverence. Not white-knuckling, not dumpster diving, but looking to a man's original subjectivity, that call to unity, through the lens and the beauty of original nakedness and innocence, to restore that gift. Because that gift doesn't lead us back to the beginning. It leads us beyond. So what I want to invite you to do, was actually under the time I was given, so here we go, is I just want to invite you to turn and maybe talk to your table. Maybe if you want to hop to another table, totally fine. But I just want to invite you. You're like, I've been seen by these people. I don't know. I'm just going to let you turn and talk. I'm not going to. You're adults. Talk about what you want. So if you want to turn to your table, maybe talk about what stood out, what didn't stand out, if you're like, oh Lord, I don't know what to say. Right? And maybe how's it calling you to change? St. Ignatius says, when we go to prayer, when we do any spiritual exercise, it should convict us and change us. So maybe what stood out, and how's it calling you to change? And maybe just ask somebody how their week was, and how they're doing, because they're a human person sitting across from you that has real struggles and real journeys.